Has any of the excitement fallen off since that momentous night this week?
Well, the phone's been ringing.
Or has it been nonstop celebrations?
Well, no, you try to get back to work as quickly as you can. In fact, next morning I got right back to work. It's where you're most comfortable.
Well, things like this do tend to generate a burst of publicity, interviews, media attention, and this sort of thing. But after a while, it dies down. You get back to work.
Fortunately, it does, yeah. These things don't maintain themselves. It would be... If they did, one would have to flee to a remote mountaintop or get in a yellow submarine.
Well, speaking of yellow submarines, being a writer is not exactly like being a rock star like the Beatles or a movie star or a TV star. I mean, you could walk down Fifth Avenue and not get mobbed, isn't it?
That's true, and not recognized. And if a survey was done of people walking on the block at that moment, probably largely unread.
That's true. I remember there was a young man at the ABA on Monday night who had never heard... Well, he had heard of you because he had seen Ragtime. He was a young man from Mutual, had the tape recorder, but he was completely unaware of any of the books that were up for nomination.
Yeah, the media people are getting younger and wetter behind the ears, I find.
And less read.
And what?
And less read. Less read.
What I mean. It's a
symptom, I think, of the
communications. There doesn't seem to be any connection between working in the media these days and a degree of informed literacy.
In fact, in talking to writers today, many of them who are trying to promote their books so that people know that they exist, because the publishers generally do a very poor job at that. If they write serious fiction, they have a difficult time getting publicity. You will rarely find a fiction writer outside of those who have developed a certain amount of fame for themselves. You will rarely find them on a television talk show or radio talk show, mostly because the talk show hosts don't read the books. They don't read the books because it's too time-consuming, too difficult, and they don't have the inclination to do it.
That's true. It's really true, although I have to say that in one or two cases recently, I was quite pleasantly surprised. People who did the interview had not only read the book we were talking about, but several of my books. So I'm very lucky that way. I was making the distinction between people at the top of their trade and people coming in as young reporters, young broadcasters, who seem to have a background in communications, but not in what used to be called liberal education, that is, grounding in the humanities, in literature, in language, in thought, criticism, and so on.
I guess I was somewhat unusual because although I studied journalism and broadcasting in college, I also studied creative writing. So it's something that's always been with me, and I think that's fortuitous for a lot of people who listen to this broadcast because they will hear writers that they ordinarily would not hear.
It's quite possible that it's difficult to interview or talk to creative writers, poets, or novelists because a good deal of journalism, talk show journalism, on television certainly, is a competing form of fantasy. And fantasies don't mix. And people who do this sort of thing present themselves in a way sort of repeatedly as fixtures in the homes of viewers. And they become great abstractions, great people who appear behind the same table every night at the same time, talking to an endless parade of other people become sort of archetypes in the minds of the audience and fantasy figures. They have no reality at any other time except the time slot they're in, and maintain a constant persona, you see. It's very difficult when you're busy doing that to really connect with other minds and delve into them.
I seem to recall an interview that you gave some years ago. I can't remember exactly where I read it, in which you were quoted as saying something to the effect that sometimes writers get too much publicity, and as a result, that detracts from their work. I'm not so sure that's accurate, though, because it seems to me that if a writer doesn't seek out a forum to talk about his work could be overlooked.
Well, of course, it's terrible for a writer to be ignored and unread. And every writer, to a certain extent, is interested in talking about himself and his work. What I meant to say was that in the perceptions of the audience, of the readers, very often the personality of the writer, if the promotion is really keen and aggressive, constant, and lasts a long time, the perception of the writer transcends or becomes paramount in the mind of the reader. And it becomes another way of not dealing with the writer's work. I was talking actually about Faulkner, and I ventured to suggest that more people in this country know that Faulkner was an alcoholic than have read Light in August, for instance. That's what I'm talking about. One way not to deal with the work and the challenges of the work, on the connections it might make with your own life, is to contemplate the author and the way he lives and what he says and the trouble he gets into and the scandals he provokes. To the extent that authors encourage that kind of attention, you see, then they are working against themselves, I think.
John Barth was telling me that he likes to talk about his work, and he has a very school teacherish approach, if you've ever heard him, but he's absolutely fascinating. But he says, you know, I'm not a heavy drinker. You know, I don't go out. I don't get into fistfights. I don't box. I don't stab my wives. I don't do any of those things. I live a very quiet, casual life in Baltimore on the eastern shore of Maryland, and I go back and forth, and I teach, and I write my books, and that's the way I like it. And he doesn't want to stand out as a personality. At least that's his claim.
Yeah. Well, you... different writers are writers first and people second, and perhaps have no choice about the way they choose to be. I mean, Hemingway was the classic example of the man who pressed for attention through his work, in front of his work, and finally blocking it out pretty much altogether. So it's very hard today to distinguish between Hemingway and what he's written. And a large number of people who think they know Hemingway's work simply know about him. But
that's true. And
I think the key thing is there's a certain amount of natural curiosity. There's no question about that, and it's appropriate. But if I were to give any reader a clue, I would suggest that he or she follow Lawrence's advice, which is to don't trust the writer, trust the book.
What you said about Hemingway is absolutely true. And do you know what an enormous amount of material has been written about Hemingway? I mean, I think it's far surpasses Hemingway's own output. So he's become a mythic figure.
Well, he very much made the created the idea of the writer as a hero. It's sort of a 20th century version of Romanticism. You think of Liszt doing the same thing for concert pianists in the 19th century, you have a pretty good idea of what Hemingway was about.
Well, let's talk about you and your work in rereading World's Fair, now in paperback. I began to think about about autobiography. Of course, World's Fair is a novel, and it's not autobiography, but there are obviously autobiographical elements in it. And it occurred to me as I was reading that when a writer uses autobiographical elements to create a novel, in effect what he is doing is, it allows him to fabricate, to exaggerate, and it allows him not to be held accountable to the truth, doesn't it? Because you can change names, change locations, exaggerate events, do anything you want.
Well, that depends on what you think of the truth is. I don't think of truth as being attached necessarily to facts. There's visionary truth, there's revealed truth, discovered truth. There's the truth in religion, which is not factual, perception, revelation of a superior force in our lives. There's nothing factual about that. I think insofar as my books go, that every one of them is highly autobiographical, even the ones that take place in previous centuries and times before I lived, places I've never been. This book, World's Fair, is no more, no less autobiographical than any of the others. Its sources, perhaps, are different. I do use personal memories to build a book on, but the book is a composition, as all the other books are. And it's true, there are exaggerations, there are imaginative rearrangements of what might have actually happened. There are interpretations of people and events. That's what fiction is. In fact, that's what life is, if you think about it. We all go around composing our lives every day, every moment of our working, and certainly our dreaming lives is self-generated. If you look around you, there's very little that is natural or factual about the way we live. I mean, the architecture, the buildings we live in, the streets we walk on, the books we read, the television, the films, restaurants we eat in, everywhere we go is a man-made world. It's a composition. Why deprive fiction writers of that same privilege? I think the key question is not whether World's Fair is autobiographical, but whether it becomes autobiographical to the reader as he or she reads it. If it becomes his life, then you see, then you've done something good.
Why an autobiographical fiction? Why not just an autobiography?
Well, I don't know anything about autobiography. I've never written one. I'm not an autobiographer. I'm a fiction writer. You go back to the idea of the writer living a quiet life. Most writers actually do, and it's quite different from the fantasy of themselves they might project, self-aggrandizing they do, self-promoting they do. And therefore, quite ordinary and uneventful and satisfying.
Well, you're just going to have to start doing some big game hunting and being some airplanes.
Well,
crash.
But the point I'm making is, if I were to write an autobiography, it would be totally unexceptional. It would be describing a life that is everyone's life, at least everyone in the middle class. I think that you get in this game not to record what happens to you, but to propose in some visionary way what things are really like, what happens below the actuality of factual events. It's a form of exploration. I think a novelist is a kind of detective, really. He goes after, he takes clues, and he builds cases and tries to find resolution of those cases after the fact. Novelists always write after the fact of life. They're always pursuing it. They're always rushing after it, trying to decide who's guilty and who's innocent.
The poet Langston Hughes wrote two volumes of autobiography, and his biographer tells me that the books are lies, that they aren't really autobiography, because he changes dates, changes names, changes events, writes fictitious happenings. So, in effect, Langston Hughes wrote fictional memoirs,
well,
not straight autobiography.
Perhaps there's no real distinction to be made between fiction and nonfiction, but only between good fiction and bad fiction. I've been criticized for supposedly mixing fact and fiction, and of playing with the truth or stretching it, perhaps. And this is not so. In Ragtime, for instance, I represent J.P. Morgan as a certain way that I think is absolutely true, even though I have him doing things the historical Morgan never did. But if you read his authorized biography, which he may have even paid for, who knows, that is his clearly a fictional creation. So the saving grace about novelists, about writers of fiction, is that since something is labeled as fiction, you see, you know that you know not to be taken in. And if you are taken in, then it shows what immense power of truth resides in the book.
Well, I think it's axiomatic that autobiography is self-serving. But the ideas for World's Fair must have been in your mind for some time, because in Lives of the Poets you make reference to the Bronx childhood of your protagonist in World's Fair. And in fact, it's in at least one of the short stories and in the novella, and some of the names, I think the names of the ants are the same, although the narrator's name is different. It's Jonathan in the Lives of the Poets and rather than Edgar. But this, you must have been bouncing these ideas around for quite a while before you actually began World's Fair. Is that true?
Well, the genesis, you're sort of getting there. The genesis of World's Fair is in a story that appears in Lives of the Poets, actually the first story, a story called The Writer and the Family. That's a story about a teenage boy whose father has died, but whose grandmother, his father's mother, doesn't know this. She's very old and in a nursing home. And his aunts suggest to him that he write letters in his father's voice, because they have represented to the old lady that the father and his family have gone to Arizona for his bronchial condition. And so the boy begins to write letters pretending to be his father. That's the premise of the book and of the story. And when the story was finished, I realized that I had the makings there, possibly something more, of the lives of this fictional family before the father died, perhaps beginning with the boys, the young writer and the family's own infancy. And that's how World's Fair came into being. This is the way it is in writing. One thing leads to another. And if you're lucky, you're aware not of composing things, but of discovering them, of finding things that you need just when you need them.
Well, here you grew up in the Bronx. You had a relatively literary household. In fact, you were named for a literary figure, D.H. Lawrence. That was supposed to be a joke. And here you left the Bronx and you went out to Ohio, to Kenyon. Now, this seems to be an unlikely location for an Easterner, someone from New York City. How did you make that decision?
Yeah, whenever I think about it now, I'm quite amazed at myself. It's even more bizarre than that. Not only was I a New Yorker going out to the Midwest, thus reversing the traditional journey of coming from the farm to the Ivy League college or the big city school, but I went to the Bronx High School of Science, and where the emphasis was very much on math and science and scientific aptitude and training in the hard scientists and hard sciences, and I had no gift or aptitude for that, fled west to a school that was known for its literary faculty, in literature and philosophy and language. I think what happened was that I read the essays of a wonderful poet and critic named John Kuransom, and somehow learned through catalogs or perhaps the words of friends or adults that he was in residence at Kenyon College in Ohio. And I thought I'd apply there to see if I could actually study with a man who somehow I related to as a reader. There's something about his the way he talked about poetry that and literature that attracted me enormously. And I did apply, and I was accepted. I applied to several schools, some where I wasn't accepted. But I also thought at the age of 17 that I really wanted to leave home. I wanted to leave home unequivocally. I didn't want to be in some kind of situation in which I'd be within commuting distance on weekends, for instance. I didn't want to be 100 miles away or 50 miles away. I wanted really to be away. And Kenyon is about 600 miles or so from New York, which would make it pretty well impossible to flee to my home except on major holidays. And that worked out very nicely. It became a very important thing in my life to be an independent young scholar and general hellraiser in a lovely rustic setting. Kenyon is a beautiful campus. Oddly enough, I didn't end up as an English major, but as a philosophy major. I fell under the sway of two philosophers there, Philip Blair Rice and Virgil Aldrich, wonderful teachers, and got all excited about metaphysics and aesthetics and logic and value theory, and took only those English courses as a non-English major that I wanted to take, including Mr. Ransom's poetry study courses and his
that fugitive movement of poets kind of moved to Kenyon, didn't it?
Kenyon had that kind of life in those days. To a lesser extent today, it's more perhaps a sounder, more solidly rooted school across the board in the liberal arts and in sciences as well. In those days, it was a Robert Penn Warren once told me that for a moment there, perhaps in the late 40s, Kenyon was probably the best school in the country.
Robert Lowell graduated from Kenyon.
Robert Lowell, Peter Taylor, Randall Jarrell was a young teacher there. My classmates.
People came up from Vanderbilt. They immigrated from
Vanderbilt.
Well,
they had this kind of southern. Their politics, their the gentleman's. Sort of antebellum agrarian politics were not to my taste, but I loved the way they, I'm talking of Ransom now, I loved the way they responded to literature, and what they taught me about it was immense, paying attention to the text regarding language, something that was capable of great precision. And but people like Lowell and Jarrell, so they were known in our day as the Golden Age. We were, I don't know what we would be called, the late James Wright, the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, was a classmate of mine. There were a lot of good poets then at Kenyon, good college poets. Some went on, some didn't. But he was probably the best.
In fact, there was a writer I just interviewed a while back, whose name escapes me, but he wrote a very fine biography of Thomas Merton, who is teaching, he is currently teaching at Kenyon. So I think the literary tradition is still there.
Oh, yeah, they have some very fine people, and perhaps it's just the old grad kind of syndrome I'm giving you now. All I'm saying is that it's probably has a greater breadth of talent in more fields than it did in the 50s when I was there.
Do you go back for awards and prizes and things?
Oh, yes, from time to time. I've delivered a commencement address and received an honorary degree and all that sort of thing, and it's always very nice to go and see how it's changed. And among other things, women go to Kenya now. It's not an all-men's school.
Well, out of the service, out of college, you became involved in publishing. You became an editor at NAL. You became editor-in-chief and publisher of the Dial Press. I wonder about that experience. You were in publishing for quite a while, but I wonder how one reconciles a desire to be a writer with actually doing the work necessary to publish books. Was it hard?
Well, at a certain point, I did have to leave publishing. It was a clear conflict in me. I reached a point in my life where I had to decide what I wanted to do. You know, the editor's life is a very interesting life, a constant buzz of creativity. An editor acquires books, thinks them up, finds people to do them, and sometimes even edits them. One of the things I learned that was very valuable to me, though, before I did leave the profession, was how to crack books down and put them back together. Dealing with the work of other authors, I was able to become so familiar with books as to lose my awe for them and deal with them with that kind of enlightened expert rudeness that, for instance, a surgeon might get into someone's chest with. That is to say, very happily going through bone, blood, and guts in order to make things right. Most people, when they see words on a page, think, well, that's it. You know, nothing can be changed. It's fixed and forever. But what an editor knows, of course, is that everything can be changed. As much as has to be changed can. This chapter belongs up there. This material should go entirely. This stuff is self-indulgent. This is unrealized. And as working as an editor closely with authors, I think I learned a good deal about how to structure a book, how to maintain the tension of a book, for instance, how to write character, how to make time pass, do all these things. It was very, of course, useful to me as a writer.
Well, as a veteran writer, do you make use of another editor, an editor to help you with your process?
I do. Find my editor's comments valuable. They come at a point in my work when I've done some of the editing myself, however, and our conversations are not my editor's Jason Epstein at Random House, very astute, very perceptive reader. And our conversations are relatively short about these matters because there's a kind of, an understanding, perhaps even non-verbals, that when some small thing is said, its implications are quite clear to both of us.
Of course, I would assume most editors would like to receive a manuscript that is, in effect, finished. I understand John Updike has a reputation for doing that, in effect. But there are writers who have needed editing and didn't seem to have it. I remember reading a book some years ago by James Jones called, I think it was called, Go to the Widowmaker. And this dealt with Jones and a mistress that he had and was set in the Caribbean with a lot of deep sea diving. It was really quite a remarkable novel and an underrated novel by James Jones. But as I was reading it, I would come to a chapter and I thought, I've read this chapter before. I mean, my bookmark must have dropped out. And I would be reading on, and I would come to a stretch of dialogue, and I said, I've read that stretch of dialogue someplace before. By the end of the book, I realized that the book had been so repetitive and redundant that had he been edited, he might have made that into one of his best books instead of a book that was not very critically accepted. So I wonder if sometimes editors are in such awe of writers. Now, you said you were not. But if an E.L. Doctorow comes in with a manuscript, not to someone like Epstein, but a young editor, isn't he likely to say, well, Mr. Doctorow, anything you want?
When I was a young editor, I try to make a rule for myself to tend to the book and not the author. An author is no guarantee of anything, actually. And I remember as a young editor working with Norman Mailer and James Baldwin, and the real pros don't pull rank on you when you're an editor. They know you're there for their sake, and you wouldn't be functioning properly if you didn't tell it the way it was. Say, look, you really need this. Do you? Some authors say to you in advance, as one or two did, look, I can't take editing. This is the best I can do. Apart from the copy editing that might be done, the fact-checking, I'm sorry, but this is it. You can reject it or accept it as you fit. And others will actually make themselves unapproachable. They'll go to Europe and send you the book from Europe. So, you know, it becomes a long problem, unless you want to fly over there, if you have any major problems with it. And so sometimes books get published that should have been worked on a bit more. There's another thing. I don't know what the situation was with James Jones, but there's probably more pressure on editors today not to edit, not to take the time to edit. And the actual close editing is done by an associate or subaltern of the editor, backup editor, a house editor. The editor himself or herself being too busy acquiring books, you see, to actually sit down and work them over.
There's a writer, a Brooklyn writer, a very unusual writer, and has not received the benefit of the recognition he should have, I think. His name is James Purdy, and his editor at Viking was Cork Smith. And in the middle of the editing of this, one of his more recent books, Smith left. I think he's at Tickner and Fields now. I'm not sure. I think he's at Tickner and Fields. And they gave this manuscript to, an associate editor who was just out of college, 20-odd years old, and gave this book no editing at all. And Purdy, not feeling completely confident in himself, was demanding editing. He wanted feedback. He wanted changes. He wanted advice, and he never got it. So the book was published. I thought it was pretty good. It did not get good reviews. But I thought it was pretty good. But I can understand that a writer wants the sympathetic hand of an editor, whether it's a comment about how a book is to be organized or just the support. Because the creative process, it seems to me, is one that for many people is a staggering influence that can just sap one of all of his strength. And I think he needs this. Doesn't a writer need that kind of
support? I think most writers do. When you're a young writer, you certainly want the support of the editor. You want his encouragement or her encouragement. And most of all, you want that editor to have to be in a position to see that the book is published well. That, of course, is another function of the editor, to sort of light a fire under the other people in the publishing house whose work is very important, the publicists, the art directors, the salespeople. You've got to get them excited about a book, and that's why there are these semi-annual rituals where the editors, they all go off to some isolated motel or the wealthy publishing house down to the Caribbean somewhere or Florida, and they have their sales meeting there where the editors present the books for the coming season to the sales and marketing people. So you need an editor who's enthusiastic about your work and can create that enthusiasm across the board in the publishing house. That's an extremely important thing, function of an editor.
Well, you were publishing for quite a while. I would imagine that the Book of Daniel was the springing point to allow you to go off on your own. But a Knopf editor named Gordon Lish was telling me that anybody who wants to write should never get into anything having to do with books, although he himself has done it. And Judith Rossner said that while she has dabbled in the fringes of publishing, it's always in some job like a secretary. And every time she would get a promotion and get a more responsible job, she would quit it because there were these distractions that tended to curb the ability of a writer to work. Now, I'm not sure that's true, because it seems to me that everybody is constituted differently, and that some people can do it, some people cannot. And there's no formula that's going to establish what one should do in life and how he should approach his writing.
I agree with that. I was discouraged. I was told when I announced my intention to write that I should stay away from publishing and get a job, traditional job for writer, digging ditches or washing dishes in diners or something of the sort. But actually, I think for me it was a very good move. I served an apprenticeship before I got my first publishing job as a reader for motion picture firm. And it was an arduous and very often tormenting job, but it was a real apprenticeship. I think I read a book a day, 5 days a week, and wrote a synopsis of it and a comment on whether or not it would be a publishing success or indeed if it was a possible movie. Film. I did that for 3 years. And everyone said, well, how can you write your own work when you go home? Don't you want to scream and so on? But it was possible. It was possible for me to do that, in fact, and discover that a novel in myself that I wouldn't have discovered had it not been a motion picture reader reading all those dreadful westerns that they were producing in those days, and deciding that I could write a novel about the West that was superior to everything I was reading. And that's how my first book, Welcome to Hard Times, got written. I'd never been west of Ohio, Kenyon, when that book was published. In fact, I thought Ohio was the West. And I think it's a good book. It's been in print ever since, in 1960, and it stands up. And exactly as a result of the peculiar circumstance of working as a reader. So, I mean, some people it works, and others it doesn't. And finally, when I was in the midst of my third novel, The Book of Daniel, it became clear to me that I couldn't do that anymore. I really had to get out of town. And so I did. But until then, I think the general experience as an editor and as a reader was more valuable to me than washing any number of dishes.
What was the emotional feeling like for you when you had finished Welcome to Hard Times and suddenly someone placed this finished book into your hands?
It was a thrilling moment. Perhaps even more thrilling was seeing my prose in print for the first time in galleys, in those long sheets which have perhaps 3 or 3.5 pages worth of print on them. When I got the galleys for my first novel, I was dazzled to think that my words would be in print for the first time. I had not previously published stories in the way of young writers, publishing around in little magazines and so on. I went right to novels, and so that was my first experience, seeing my own words in print, and that was a thrilling moment. And then to see that later on the jacket and the covers around the thing.
Did you feel divorced from it, that here is an object that you're holding in your hand that you wrote, and yet could somebody else have written this?
Well, I don't remember exactly how I felt then. Perhaps some pride and resolve that this meant that I indeed was a writer and could go on writing and live this way. That's probably what I felt. In retrospect, of course, you understand as a writer that when the work is over, the book is no longer you're no longer in it. It does become rather remote. Nothing after is quite as can quite match the composition, the process of writing, and so you do get sometimes you even get depressed when the book is finished, like the end of a relationship of some sort, and you. you realize that someone who's read it recently, if a book is 10, 20 years old, even 2 or 3 years old, is probably closer to that book than you are, and with a reasonable intelligence, more enlightened about what it does and how it succeeds and how it fails than you are.
And in fact, I have talked to writers about passages, episodes in some of their books, and they don't recall. I was talking to William Manchester, who'd written a wonderful memoir about his experiences in as a Marine in the Pacific, and there was a thrilling episode involving the Japanese attack. It was all about Japanese attacks, of course. And I cited this, and he was scratching his head, and I said, and I cited the names of the characters, and he was scratching his head. So I opened the book, and I turned to it, and he said, "Oh, that's right, it is in my book." So I wonder if sometimes a writer can just put aside this work and go on to something else, and in a way, what he's done is repressed.
You know, the fear of the story about Tolstoy. We were in Russia this summer and went to his estate at Yasna Polyana, about 100 miles outside of Moscow. And I remember that great story. I actually stood at the door where he was said to have been standing. He'd been passing by, and his daughters were in the room reading aloud to one another. And he's passing by, and he leaned in the door, and he listened for a while, and he said, "That's not bad. Who wrote that?" And the girls were shocked, of course. They said, "Papa, that's Anna Karenina."
Strangely, the one book that I'm not familiar with that you wrote was your second one, Big as Life. I don't think I've ever seen that.
Yeah, well, Big as Life was didn't work. And it was an unhappy experience in the writing. I never really quite understood what I was doing in that book. And in the publishing, and it had a very modest printing. And
who published that book?
I don't think that book was published by Simon & Schuster. And it got a few good reviews, but I wasn't happy with the book, and I'd spent too much time on it. So I resolved someday to do it again, to rework it. In the meantime, I've prevented it from being published in any other edition. So there are just those, I don't know, 3,000 copies floating around in rare bookstores, rare booksellers' shelves. And I still have in mind someday to go back and make, sort of reinvent that book. But until I do, I just assume it was not available to. I'm very sensitive about that book. It's in my mind, it's still unpublished. It's still in working manuscript.
John Fowles did that, I believe, with a book called The Magus, where he has a revised edition of The Magus, which is supposed to be the definitive work. But he was extremely unhappy with the original version of that. So that's not certainly not unusual. I think John Barth also has a revised edition of The Floating Opera. I think it's The Floating Opera. Yeah, The Floating Opera, which was his first book. And he rewrote that, and there's a revised edition. I don't know how that differs from the original.
This does happen. Joyce wrote a perfectly respectable novel called Stephen Hero, which displeased him so that he transformed it into Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man.
Well, E.L. Doctorow, we've chatted longer than I had intended, about 45 minutes or so, and I enjoyed talking about the creative process with you and how you work and how you function, and I congratulate you again for winning the American Book Award for World's Fair. It was certainly deserved and a thrilling moment for me to be there when that award was announced. And so I hope it doesn't go to your head, and you're going to get back to the typewriter or whatever you use.
Just the minute I leave this studio.
I hope so. Thank you very much.
Thank you.